A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a live wire. Under current EU law, Trump can't run for a third term in 2028. But what if a majority of voters want him to? That's the tension. On one side, term limits look anti-democratic. Why should a piece of paper override the will of the people? On the other side, if the same leader keeps winning, is that still a democracy, or is it drifting toward autocracy? And then he points to Israel, where Netanyahu just keeps getting reelected, and asks, does Israel even have term limits? So where do we start with this?
We start by admitting that term limits are philosophically strange. They're a rule that says democracy can't fully trust itself. You're telling voters, you can choose anyone except that person you keep choosing.
Which is a weird thing for a democracy to say.
And yet, over 80% of presidential democracies have some form of term limit. So the world has largely decided this weird anti-democratic rule is necessary.
The world's democracies looked at the buffet and collectively said, yes, I'll have the self-restraint and also the hypocrisy on the side.
That's the dish. So let's define the dissonance properly. Term limits are anti-majoritarian by design. They exist precisely to override majority preference in specific circumstances. You could have 60%, 70% of voters wanting someone to stay, and the Constitution says no. That's not a bug, it's the feature. The question is whether that feature protects democracy or undermines it.
We've got two case studies that sit at opposite ends of the spectrum. The United States with the 22nd Amendment, ratified in 1951. No president serves more than two terms. And Israel, whose basic law on the government imposes no term limit on the prime minister at all. Netanyahu has served over 16 years across multiple stretches, and legally, there's nothing stopping him from serving another 16.
The core question is this. Is a democracy that repeatedly re-elects the same leader still a democracy, or does it drift toward something else? And how have political theorists actually grappled with this? Because it's not a new problem, it predates both Trump and Netanyahu by centuries.
The Romans had something to say about this, didn't they?
The Roman Republic had a principle called collegiality, two consuls serving one-year terms specifically to prevent power concentration, and they had a mandatory 10-year gap between consulships. Cincinnatus was celebrated because he took power, did the job, and went back to his farm. The fear of permanent rule was baked into Republican thinking from the start.
The original term limits guy was literally a farmer who didn't want the gig.
That ethos carried into the American founding. But here's the thing. The U Constitution, as originally written, had no presidential term limits. Washington set the two-term president voluntarily, and it held as an informal norm for over 150 years.
Until FDR blew through it.
1932, 36, 40, and 44. He died in office in 1945, and within 2 years, the Republican-controlled Congress proposed the 22nd Amendment. It was ratified by the states on February 27, 1951.
The amendment wasn't some noble philosophical statement. It was a direct reaction to one man holding power for 12-plus years, through the Depression and World War II.
And the key driver was fear of executive overreach, not anti-democratic sentiment. The argument wasn't, voters are stupid. The argument was, the executive branch accumulates power with each successive term, and eventually the institutional checks become too weak. FDR had tried to pack the Supreme Court in 1937. He'd created a vast administrative state. By the end, critics argued, the presidency had become too powerful for any one person to hold indefinitely.
The 22nd Amendment is less about limiting voters and more about limiting the office itself from becoming a platform for permanent rule.
And that distinction matters philosophically. Let me bring in Madison here. In Federalist No. 10, he argued that factions are the great threat to Republican government, not just mobs, organized interests that can capture institutions. His solution was structural, a large republic with checks and balances that make it hard for any one faction to dominate. Term limits fit squarely in that tradition. They're a structural check against factional entrenchment.
The Madisonian view says, even if a majority supports a leader, that majority might be a faction that's captured the state, and the Constitution needs to protect against that, which is a pretty paternalistic view of voters.
And that's exactly where the tension lives. The will of the people argument says, if 60% of voters want a third term, why should a 75-year-old amendment override their sovereignty? And this isn't just theoretical. Pew Research did a poll in March 2024. 38% of Americans said they support repealing the 22nd Amendment. That's not a fringe position.
What's the partisan split?
52% of Republicans support repeal versus 26% of Democrats. So it's heavily asymmetric, which makes sense given that Trump is the only recent president who's openly mused about a third term.
If you're a Trump supporter, the logic feels airtight. We won. We should get to keep winning. That's how democracy works.
That's where political scientists like Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt push back hard. In their 2018 book, How Democracies Die, they define something called democratic backsliding. The pattern isn't a coup. It's not tanks in the streets. It's elected leaders who win repeatedly and then use their mandate to weaken institutions from within. Courts, the press, election oversight, the civil service. They win elections, but they hollow out the system that makes elections meaningful.
The nightmare scenario isn't that a popular leader declares himself emperor. It's that he wins fair elections while gradually making sure nobody else ever can.
That's the mechanism. And Levitsky and Ziblatt point to examples like Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, Viktor Orban in Hungary, Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey. All were democratically elected, all kept winning, all presided over democratic erosion.
Orban's a good example. He's been prime minister since 2010, four consecutive terms. Hungary still holds elections, the ballots are counted. But the media landscape, the judiciary, the electoral system itself have been so thoroughly reshaped that the playing field is tilted beyond recognition.
That's the counterargument to the pure will of the people position. Democracy isn't just about counting votes on election day, it's about the conditions under which those votes are cast and counted. If the incumbent can use state resources, friendly media, and captured courts to make themselves unbeatable, then each successive election becomes less meaningful, even if the counting is technically accurate.
The anti-term limits view treats democracy as a single moment, the election. The pro-term limits view treats democracy as an ecosystem that needs to be maintained across elections.
That's beautifully put, and it's exactly the framework that political theorist Robert Dahl developed. Dahl is one of the giants of democratic theory. He wrote Polyarchy in 1971 and basically defined how we think about democratic institutions. He identified this thing he called the democratic paradox. Democracies need both responsiveness to voters and constraints on power. You can't have one without the other, but they're in constant tension. Term limits are a constraint that, in theory, enhances long-term democratic health even when they frustrate short-term majority will.
It's like a marathon runner who stops for water. In the moment, stopping feels slower. Over the full race, it prevents collapse.
That's the idea. Now let's flip the script entirely and look at a country with no term limits at all, Israel.
Where the marathon runner never stops for water, and everyone's arguing about whether he's still running or just wandering.
Israel's legal framework is completely different from the EU, the Basic Law on the Government. Originally passed in 1992 and revised in 2001, sets no term limit for the prime minister. The only requirement is that the prime minister be a sitting member of the Knesset. There's no cap on years, no cap on consecutive terms, nothing.
Netanyahu has taken full advantage of that. He first served from 1996 to 1999, then came back from 2009 to 2021, then returned in late 2022. Total, over 16 years as prime minister, making him the longest-serving leader in Israeli history, surpassing David Ben-Gurion.
The consequences of that extended tenure are exactly what the term limits debate is about. In 2023, Netanyahu's government pushed a major judicial reform package that would have given the Knesset power to override Supreme Court decisions and given the government more control over judicial appointments. The response was the largest protest movement in Israeli history, over 600,000 people in the streets in March 2023.
600,000 in a country of about 9.5 million. That's proportionally equivalent to about 20 million Americans protesting.
The core argument of the protesters was precisely about institutional erosion. They weren't just disagreeing with a policy. They were saying, the Prime Minister, after so many years in power, is reshaping the institutions that are supposed to check him. The Supreme Court, the Attorney General's office, the civil service, all had been targets of long-term pressure.
Netanyahu's defenders would say, he kept getting elected. That's democracy. The protesters lost the election. They should accept it.
Which brings us right back to the paradox. If you keep winning elections while weakening the institutions that guarantee free elections, are you still a Democrat? Or are you, as Levitsky and Ziblatt would say, a competitive authoritarian, someone who tolerates elections as long as they win them?
The competitive part doing a lot of work there.
It really is. Now, let me add some global context, because this isn't just a few different democracies have answered this question very differently. Germany, the chancellor has no formal term limit in the basic law, the Grundgesetz, but there's a strong informal convention against serving more than two terms. Konrad Adenauer served 14 years, Helmut Kohl 16. Both stepped down without being forced by law. France, since the 2008 constitutional reform, the president is limited to two consecutive five-year terms. South Korea, a single five-year term, no re-election allowed at all.
A single term is brutal. You barely figure out where the bathrooms are, and you're out.
South Korea adopted that in their 1987 constitution, specifically because of their history with authoritarian presidents. Park Chung-hee ruled for 18 years, and the single-term limit was designed to make sure that could never happen again. The trade-off is that every South Korean president becomes a lame duck almost immediately, which creates its own governance problems.
Mexico has something similar. A single six-year term, no re-election ever. The sexenio, the six-year non-renewable term, was literally a reaction to Porfirio Diaz, who ruled for over 30 years.
And the Mexican rule is the most extreme version. Not only can you not run again, you can never run again. Once you've been president, you're done forever. It's a constitutional flamethrower aimed at the problem of entrenchment.
We've got a spectrum. On one end, Israel and the UK, no formal term limits for the head of government, just the electoral process. On the other end, Mexico and South Korea, single terms, no re-election. France, and most of Latin America, sit somewhere in the middle with two term limits.
There's actual empirical research on which approach works better. A 2019 study published in the American Political Science Review, this was by political scientists at the University of Chicago and Princeton, looked at presidential term limits across 137 countries from 1900 to 2010. The finding? Presidential term limits reduce the risk of democratic breakdown by about 40% in new democracies.
40% is enormous.
But here's the nuance. The effect was much weaker in established democracies. In countries with long democratic traditions and strong institutions, term limits mattered less. The protective effect was concentrated in countries where democracy was still fragile.
Which makes intuitive sense. If your courts are independent and your press is free and your civil service is professional, a popular leader can't easily dismantle those things even with multiple terms. If those institutions are already weak, term limits are a crucial backstop.
And that's the calibration problem. In 2026 is not Hungary in 2010. The question is whether American institutions are strong enough that the 22nd Amendment is an unnecessary restriction on voter choice, or whether the last decade suggests those institutions are more fragile than we thought.
The Trump years put a lot of stress on norms that people assumed were unbreakable. The refusal to concede in 2020, the pressure campaign on state election officials, the January 6th Capitol breach, those weren't institutional failures exactly, but they revealed how much depends on people choosing to follow norms rather than being forced to.
That's the argument for keeping the 22nd Amendment. It's not that Trump specifically would become a dictator in a third term, it's that the amendment removes the question entirely. You don't have to trust norms or hope for the best. The Constitution simply says no.
Which is the Madisonian logic again? Don't rely on virtue.
Now, one misconception I want to address. A lot of people think term limits are exclusively an American thing, or exclusively a presidential system thing. That's wrong. Over 80% of presidential democracies have term limits. But parliamentary systems often lack them. The UK has no term limit for prime minister. Neither does Canada, neither does Australia. The theory is that in a parliamentary system, the prime minister can be removed by a no-confidence vote at any time, so a formal term limit is less necessary.
That theory breaks down when the prime minister's coalition is unshakable. Netanyahu has survived multiple no-confidence votes because his coalition held. Margaret Thatcher served 11 years. The parliamentary safety valve only works if the parliament actually uses it.
Israel's experience shows what happens when the safety valve rusts shut. Netanyahu's coalitions have been remarkably stable, and even when he was briefly out of power in 2021 to 2022, he came back. The system didn't produce alternation. It produced a temporary interruption.
One thing that's striking about Israel is that there's no serious movement to introduce term limits. It's not part of the political conversation in any meaningful way.
Which is fascinating because Israel's political system has been under enormous strain. The judicial reform crisis, the repeated elections, 5 elections in 4 years between 2019 and 2022, the deep polarization. You'd think term limits would at least be on the table as a reform proposal.
Part of it might be that Israel's proportional representation system already produces coalition governments, so the prime minister is always constrained by partners. In theory, anyway. Another part is that the right-wing bloc sees Netanyahu as irreplaceable, and the left-wing bloc doesn't want to concede that his longevity is the problem. They want to beat him at the ballot box.
Which gets at something deeper. Term limits are, in a sense, an admission of failure. They're a confession that the normal democratic process can't produce alternation on its own. That's a hard thing for a democracy to admit about itself.
We can't trust ourselves to fire the guy, so we're building a self-destruct mechanism into the job.
That's the unflattering version. The more generous version is, we're building a failsafe, like a circuit breaker. It's not that we expect the house to catch fire, but if it does, we want something that trips before the whole thing burns down.
Let me try to synthesize the theoretical side here. We've got the pure democratic position. Term limits are illegitimate constraints on popular sovereignty. We've got the Madisonian position. Term limits are structural safeguards against factional capture. And we've got the Dole position. Democracies need both responsiveness and constraint, and the right balance depends on context. Is that a fair map?
That's the map. And I'd add one more layer. The empirical evidence says term limits matter most where institutions are weakest, which suggests the Dole framework is right. The answer isn't universal, it's calibrated.
For a country like the United States, with 2 centuries of constitutional tradition, strong courts, and a professional civil service, you could argue the 22nd Amendment is overkill. The institutions can handle a third term.
You could argue that. The counterargument is that the 22nd Amendment is part of why those institutions are still strong. It's not an external constraint, it's woven into the fabric. Remove it, and you change the incentives for everyone downstream. A president who can run again governs differently than one who can't. Donors behave differently. Opponents behave differently. The media behaves differently.
A lame duck's power is fundamentally different from a potential 3-term president's power.
That's what critics of repeal worry about. It's not that Trump wins a 3rd term and declares martial law. Is that the mere possibility of a 3rd term changes the behavior of everyone around him. More deference, less willingness to challenge, more pressure on institutions to align with the executive.
The chilling effect before the fact.
Now let's look ahead. The 2028 U election is going to test the 22nd Amendment's resilience in a very concrete way. Trump has made comments, sometimes joking, sometimes less joking, about a 3rd term. There's a faction within the Republican Party that genuinely supports repeal. And if Trump were to push for it seriously, the legal path would be daunting. A constitutional amendment requires 2/3 of both houses of Congress and ratification by 3/4 of the states. That's almost impossible in the current political environment.
Almost impossible has done a lot of work in American politics lately.
And there are fringe legal theories floating around. The argument that the 22nd Amendment only prohibits being elected to a 3rd term, not succeeding to one. Could Trump run as vice president on a ticket where the presidential candidate resigns immediately after inauguration? It's a wild theory, and most constitutional scholars dismiss it, but the fact that it's even being discussed tells you something about the moment.
It tells me people are looking for loopholes in a document that was specifically designed to have no loopholes on this point.
Meanwhile, Israel has an election scheduled for October 2026. Netanyahu will presumably lead Likud again. If he wins, he extends his tenure further into uncharted territory. And the question of what prolonged rule does to Israeli democracy will become even more acute.
The two cases are running in parallel, testing opposite hypotheses. Is testing whether a term limit can hold against a popular leader who wants to break it. Israel is testing whether a democracy without term limits can maintain institutional health against a leader who keeps winning.
Neither test has a clear answer yet, but the empirical literature suggests we should be watching Israel more nervously. The countries that slid into competitive authoritarianism in the 21st century, Hungary, Turkey, Venezuela, all did so without formal term limits. The erosion happened through elections, not despite them.
If you're a listener trying to think about term limits in your own country, what's the framework? How do you evaluate whether a proposed limit is good or bad?
I'd use the Dahl framework. Ask two questions. First, does this limit protect against genuine entrenchment, or does it arbitrarily restrict voter choice? If your country has weak courts, a captured media, and a history of executive overreach, term limits are probably a necessary safeguard. If your country has robust institutions and a long history of peaceful alternation, term limits might be less urgent. Second question, is the limit calibrated to your political system? A single 6-year term like Mexico's makes sense for a country with a history of 30-year dictatorships. A 2-term limit like the EU makes sense for a presidential system with strong separation of powers. No term limit at all might make sense for a parliamentary system with a strong no-confidence mechanism, but only if that mechanism actually works.
If the no-confidence mechanism is a paper tiger, you're basically Israel.
You're Israel. Or you're the UK under a leader with a massive majority. The system works until it doesn't.
The other thing I'd add is, watch the courts. In every case of democratic backsliding, the judiciary is the first major target. When a long-serving leader starts attacking judicial independence, that's the canary in the coal mine. It's not about policy disagreements. It's about whether the leader is trying to remove the institution that can rule against them.
That's exactly what happened in Hungary, in Poland, in Turkey, and what protesters feared was happening in Israel in 2023. The pattern is so consistent across countries that it's almost diagnostic.
Term limits are one tool among many. They're not a silver bullet. South Korea has a single term limit and still had a president impeached for corruption, Park Geun-hye in 2017. A term limit didn't prevent abuse of power, but it did ensure she couldn't run again.
Term limits don't guarantee good governance. They guarantee rotation. And rotation by itself has value. It brings fresh perspectives. It prevents the accumulation of patronage networks. It normalizes the idea that power is temporary.
The peaceful transfer of power is a habit, not a law of nature.
Habits need reinforcement. That's what term limits do. They reinforce the habit of alternation.
Let me ask you something forward-looking. As AI and social media reshape political campaigns, hyper-targeted messaging, deepfakes, algorithmic amplification, do term limits become more or less important?
I think they become more important, and here's why. The tools for manufacturing consent are getting dramatically more powerful. A charismatic incumbent with access to the full machinery of state communication and AI-driven persuasion can build an electoral fortress that's extremely hard to breach. In that environment, the will of the people becomes harder to interpret. Is it genuine support, or is it the product of a media ecosystem that's been systematically tilted? Term limits become a backstop against the possibility that technology has made elections less meaningful.
The counter-argument would be, if technology empowers incumbents, then term limits are even more anti-democratic, because you're taking away the voter's only tool for keeping a good leader against a technological headwind.
That's fair. But it assumes voters are perfectly rational information processors, which 50 years of political psychology says they're not. The whole point of Madisonian design is that you don't assume perfect voters. You build systems that work with imperfect ones.
If men were angels, no government would be necessary.
Federalist 51. The founders weren't optimists about human nature, they were institutional pessimists. And term limits are an expression of that pessimism, a bet that power over time corrupts even the well-intentioned.
Where does that leave us? Term limits are philosophically anti-democratic, but empirically protective of democracy. They're a confession of institutional fragility that might actually strengthen institutions. And the right answer depends on context. But the trend line globally is toward more limits, not fewer.
The big open question for the next few years is whether the established democracies, the EU, Israel, others, will hold their current positions or shift. The 2028 EU election and Israel's October 2026 election are going to provide a lot of data.
Data that we'll be living through in real time.
Which is both exciting and terrifying, depending on your temperament.
I'm a sloth. I prefer my history in retrospect.
So to wrap up, give listeners a mental model. When you hear a term limit debate in your own country, don't just ask, does this restrict voter choice? Ask, does this protect against entrenchment? The Dahl framework, balancing responsiveness and constraint, is the most useful lens. And watch the courts. When a long-serving leader starts attacking judicial independence, the term limit conversation just got urgent.
If your country doesn't have term limits and nobody's talking about them, ask why. Sometimes the absence of the conversation is the most revealing thing.
That's the Israel case in a sentence.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1950s, scientists studying the venom of the South American rattlesnake, Crotalus durissus terrificus, discovered that its venom contains a protein called crotoxin, which is not a single toxin, but a complex of two subunits that only become fully neurotoxic when they bind together outside the snake's body. A biochemical two-key system that researchers at the time described as nature's safety catch.
The rattlesnake evolved DRM for its own venom.
Nature's safety catch. I'm going to be thinking about that one.
This has been my weird prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, and to everyone who sends in prompts. If you've got a weird one, we want it. Find us at myweirdprompts.com.
Leave us a review wherever you listen.
See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.